Hello, NYC Barrow. So, this is my second or third time. I speak at a lot of New York groups, and they all sort of to blend in my mind. But I've been a BSD, right? All people. Been a BSD user since 2000. When I joined a startup and we were trying to decide, we were buying our very first server and decide what are we going to base this company on, and we went with FreeBSD. And I still think in terms of BSD, even though I do a lot of Linux stuff now, it's always my coworkers are driving crazy because they say, that's the question. I say, oh yeah, well in BSD would be blah, 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 so let's translate. And like, we're Linux people here. So anyway, so how many people here use BSD at work? Okay, and how many of you, so everyone else home users? Okay, both? Go on, awesome. And how many people here are system administrators? And software developers? Okay, so sort of split. The book is, I'm not here to sell the book, but in fact I'm here to give a copy away. But the one negative review I got was that the title should have been for system administrators and programmers, because it really applies to both. And I find that, especially in the web world, developers are more and more pushed into the insanity that is system administration often. So also just to get to know people, how many people are from Manhattan? Any out of towners? Brooklyn in the house? Let's hear from the baby. Okay, going nowhere. So let me find my clicker. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through just five key points from the book, and then open up to questions. If you have a question during the key points, raise your hand. But and I intentionally picked the most annoying transitions possible because I was playing with the new version of Keynote. So these are my top five tips. I won't read it because I'm going to go through them right now. If the clicker works, there we go. Okay, so first tip, create a mutual interrupt shield. What is a mutual interrupt shield? Now, one of the biggest problems that system administrators or developers complain about time management-wise is the number of interrupts that people get. Not hardware interrupts, but people interrupts. So, your boss is stopping by, coworker is stopping by, you got email, you got your instant message, and stock tickers and everything clicking around. So, number one technique for dealing with this, and actually I have a whole chapter on dealing with interrupts, but my favorite technique from that chapter is the mutual interrupt shield, which is essentially, in the morning, well, you make a deal with a coworker. In the morning, I will deal with all the interrupts. If someone calls, if something comes into the trouble ticket system, I'll deal with it, and that lets my coworker deal with projects. And then in the afternoon, we swap. So he's the interrupt catcher, and I get project time. And this is really important, because if you think about it, your user interrupts are sort of the enemy of getting projects done, right? And your users, they like you or don't like you if you're available. And your boss judges you if you get your projects done. And these two things conflict with each other. So with something like the mutual interrupt shield, you can at least get half a day of every day of project time. So, next thing, turning chaos into routines. I see commercials a lot of times that say, oh, get out of that, our product helps you get out of that old boring routine. I actually want to encourage you to get into that old boring routine. Life in technology is often a little too chaotic. A little chaos is okay. But here's how you can turn chaos into routines. With an example, at my previous job, my boss was in Maryland, I was in New Jersey. It was very difficult to get FaceTime with her, or just phone time with her. And as a system administrator, you often hit a roadblock that isn't going to be resolved until you can get a decision from someone higher up. And when I thought about all the time I was spending on the week playing phone tag and IM tag with her, it was totaling up to be about 2 or 3 hours per week. And it dawned on us that if we just had a routine, like every Tuesday and Thursday morning at 9 a.m., we were always going to talk to each other. Whether we thought we had something to talk about or not, whether she was at the London office or I was in California, whatever, 9 a.m. East Coast time, you're always going to talk to each other. And so now this 2 hours of running around was eliminated. And I just had the 5 or 10 minutes that I needed with my boss twice a week. So that's a huge savings. I mean, 2 out of 40 hours. You know, if I could find, you know, 5 or 6 more tips like that for you, that's you know, 16 hours a week. That's like saving 2 days a week. There's a lot of opportunities for finding routines in your day. Any kind of repeated event that could be scheduled but isn't. When procrastinating takes longer than doing the actual task, I am really good at procrastinating. A couple companies ago, we had this, it wasn't a computer room, it was more like a computer closet that was overheating. And so we brought in one of those temporary coolers, the kind that has a little tank that fills up with water and you have to empty it every, like, 3 days. And I was so good at procrastinating. I could look at that tank and say, oh, no, that has a day and a half left, or 3 hours left, or, oh, I know where the mop is, I can clean that up. So instead I turned that into a routine. I just said, in the morning, when I come in, whether I think it needs to be emptied or not, I'm just always going to empty it. That way, since it took about 3 days to empty, 3 days to fill, if I did it every day, I would never get a spill. And actually, it's a lot easier to lug a tank like that to the sink to pour it out when it's only a third full than when it's full full. So actually, the whole task became easier. So there were all these sort of domino effect of good benefits. So another opportunity is anything you forget often when you find yourself in front of your boss or coworker saying, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Maybe that's a good time to think, is there a routine I could have developed that would prevent me from forgetting in the future? For example, I always put my keys in the exact same place in the house so that when I'm leaving, I know exactly where they are. A lot of things in IT are these sort of maintenance tasks that are like gardening. So, if you have a garden, I know this is New York City, so if you have a rooftop garden, flower garden on the windowsill garden, so if you're growing carrots are something that you need to tend to a little bit throughout the course of the season, and then at the end you get a harvest. You can't ignore the garden all year and then have like a marathon weekend of gardening and boom, carrots. And IT is a lot like that. There's a lot of situations like that, both technology-wise, getting a project done, doing a little bit each day, and also relationships. So when I was at Bell Labs, my system administration team served 4 different labs at Bell Labs, computation, math, communication, and something else. Computer science, yeah. So, and we had a good relationship with some of those labs, not so good relationship with some of those labs, and one of the labs we had a really bad relationship with. We had a major outage that was not handled well, and we didn't communicate very well, and we really just screwed our relationship with this one lab. And while I would have loved to do a marathon weekend of relationship building and boom, have a better relationship with this team, that wasn't going to happen. It was going to need to be a year-long process. So I developed a routine. Every Tuesday at 10 a.m., I would walk through. In the first week, I just sort of ran through them. I was scared of these people. They were not very happy. And the second week, I said hi to people as I walked through. And the next week, I stopped at people's offices and I was chatting. And redeveloped the relationship through communication. And by the end of 6 months, we were back, the relationship was healed. We were back being invited to design meetings and stuff, and we were working as a partnership. So IT is like gardening. Tip number 3 is record all requests. We're brain people. We like to try to memorize everything. I'm a brain person. I'm not generally hired for my good looks, and that's okay. So it's very tempting for me to try to just remember, the five things that a customer has requested. But, you know, the human brain is not very good at remembering lists of things. There is no particular part of the brain that evolved to memorize a list of 100 different things. So instead, we want to use like a help desk system, like a request tracker, RT, for tracking tickets. Or if you're a more project-oriented system administration, software project, using a bug tracking system. And things that are immediate and small enough that you wouldn't open a ticket, put in your PDA, or even a notepad. So these things, a PDA, a database for tracking requests, these things become external storage for your brain and free up your brain to think about other things. And there are many, is that a question?
No.
There are many studies about what helps people concentrate, and this gets back to getting your projects in. It's easier to get a project done if you can be focused, you can have that concentrated focus. And studies find that, you know, if you have a lot on your mind, like you're trying to remember, oh, I have to buy milk on the way home, and oh, I have to get that report from my boss, and oh, this user needs, you know, blah, blah, blah. If you have those things in the back of your mind, that is actually stealing brain cycles from the project that you're working on. So by using external storage, like even just a pad of paper, it gives you better efficiency working on your projects. How many people here are in a customer-facing environment that doesn't have a trouble ticket system? Oh, okay. Let me recommend Best Practicals Request Tracker.
We have one of the products already.
Oh, okay, good. Which one?
The contact.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes.
It's ironic.
Yeah. So RT also has a new module, the FAQ Manager, which is for standard replies. Like, you get the same question a lot, you just click on, you know, that's standard reply number 5. And that product, is the FAQ Manager, is the RTFM, the RT Effects Manager. I love that company. You really want to avoid the, oh, I'll remember that trap. It's like, you know, oh, the vice president, you know, asked me to do something while walking down the hall, so, you know, that's so important, how can I possibly forget it? Well, actually, if it's really important, it's even more important that you put it in your request tracking system, so that it doesn't get forgot, and so that it does get managed to completion. Okay. Tip number 4. So speaking of PDAs, a lot of people ask me, what's a good way to manage a to-do list? How many people here maintain some kind of to-do list, electronically or on paper or whatever? Okay, wow, almost everyone. Okay, good. So I'll go through this quickly. There's some to-do list systems work better than others. The first one that I see very commonly is the memorize everything technique. And as I said before, I don't recommend this. We're smart people, but the brain isn't really good at memorizing long lists of things. In fact, as evidence that the brain isn't good at memorizing things, David Allen, who wrote a fine book on time management called Getting Things Done, often tells the story of this is how bad the brain is at memorizing to-do lists or tasks. If your flashlight is dead at home, and because you need to buy batteries, when do you remember that you need to buy batteries? When you're at the grocery store, maybe, maybe not. When you really remember it is when there's a blackout and you're about to reach for the flashlight. That's when you go, oh, I forgot to buy batteries. So the brain actually remembers things in reaction to bad stuff, because that's what was important to cavemen. But, you know, we're not cavemen anymore. Okay, so next technique that is very common, but I don't recommend it, is the zillions of scattered notes technique. It's very common. You can tell if a coworker uses this technique because on their monitor, all around the monitor are yellow sticky notes, and there's notes on the desk, and, you know, this one says call Ed and a phone number, and you can't remember, am I keeping this around because I need a phone number, or do I really need to call Ed? Who knows? You can put it back. So, and also, you go to a meeting and you you get some action items and you write them down and that list is on your desk, and you go to another meeting and you come back, now you have two lists on your desk and the sticky notes, and it gets really stressful. And soon people often really get stressed out by this. They have just too many things, it's disorganized. And so that's when they decide to graduate. And they say, you know, I'm done with the zillions of scattered notes technique. I'm going to do something better. And they buy a single notebook, and they say, I'm going to write everything in one place. No more will I have to skip between these lists and the monitor and these other things. I'm going to have one notebook. I'm going to write everything in that one place. And it works great. And for the first week, you know, you're writing stuff down, and when it's done, you cross off. It works great. And the second week, it's working pretty good. By the third week, you're spending as much time flipping through the book trying to find the things you haven't crossed off yet as you are, you know, doing any work. And then you start copying things to the back so that you can tear up, you know, you have a completed page to tear up. And it just becomes almost as unmanageable as the zillions of scattered notes technique. But even worse, this technique becomes a morale killer. Because no matter how hard you work, there's always more things to do. And you get into the syndrome that a lot of system administrators have, which is, it's time to go home, but you say, well, I still have things to do. So you either work late, become a workaholic, or you go home and you feel guilty. And if you go home and feel guilty every night of the week, that's really going to be a morale killer. And this technique becomes the never-ending list of doom. So, those are two very common techniques. I want to talk about something that's better. It's a lot more simple, and you can use open source tools to manage it. Very common open source tool for using this technique is VI, because all you need is a text editor. Emacs fans, there's actually like an Emacs mode that does this technique, which is scary because there's an Emacs mode for everything. But you can do this in Notebook or Notepad. Luckily my tasks are all alphabetical. So the idea is you maintain 365 to-do lists a year. If you had a pad of paper, and actually there are companies that sell little pocket-sized books that have 365 pages, you can do it with that, or you can do it in Notepad. Day one, let's say it's April 14th, and you have five things to do, you just write them under that day's heading. And as you do the tasks, you cross them out. Very simple. Of course, in VI, I'm not crossing them out. I'm writing the word done next to them or whatever. And then you get to the end of the day, and you still have two more tasks to do. Now, instead of working late or feeling guilty, now you control your own destiny. You decide, well, it's the end of the day, or maybe you do this at 4 o'clock so you still have more time. You say, you know, I just know I'm not going to get these two things done. So instead of feeling guilty, I'm going to move them to tomorrow's list. And in VI, you would do that by just adding tomorrow's date. Now, if they're low priority, it's very easy to add them to next day's list. If you had committed to them being done today, then you can call that person that you committed it to and say, you know, we have that outage, other things happen, I'm just not going to be able to finish this today, let's negotiate. And the person might say, well, you know, we didn't actually need that till tomorrow afternoon, so if you could get it done the first thing tomorrow, we're happy. Or maybe they say, you know, I really do need it tonight, so you decide to stay late and get it done. But either way, you're in control now because you're negotiating instead of letting other people's tasks manage your life. So Tuesday comes, now some of you are probably thinking, well, gee, Tom, that's a great system, but I don't have all my tasks laid out for me at the beginning of the day. I get tasks throughout the day. Absolutely. So as new tasks come in, again, now you have a little bit more control. Instead of always, you know, your boss or a customer or someone gives you a new task, instead of saying, oh, I'll get right on it, which is them managing your time, if you think about it, you're in control. So you can say, okay, well, you know, someone's giving me a new task, I'll just add it to today's list. I only have two things, I can handle a third thing, awesome. Or maybe you just right away say, you know, these two things that I'm working on today, they're big things. I'm not going to have time for this. And you can just right off the bat add it to tomorrow's list. And now you're telling the customer that, or your boss or whoever is giving you this task, instead of sort of cowering in fear or just saying, you know, yes, I'll do this as soon as possible, now you're giving work estimates. You're saying, okay, I think I can do this tomorrow on Wednesday. And if the person says, oh, no, I guess I haven't clearly communicated the priorities, this is really urgent, and you say, oh, okay, now I understand, I'll put it on today's list. But again, you're negotiating, you're not letting other people manage your time. And you can even put it on further out in the schedule. Maybe this is something that doesn't need to be done Thursday. Or maybe they've given you something like, could you remember on Monday to do blah, blah, blah? And so now you're scheduling work for all in the future. So instead of having a work situation that is, you know, chaotic and other people are managing your time, with something simple like this, you're scheduling your work, you're setting priorities because you have the ability to prioritize not only what day it happens, but at the beginning of the day you can look at what you have in the schedule. And you're negotiating for deadlines, both when you're assigned a task and when the task gets near its deadline and you need to call someone. So that's the very simple, I call this the cycle because if you read the book, it turns into this whole daily cycle of things that you do, not only with the task management, but your calendar management. I call it the 4 p.m. check, what I was talking about before, towards the end of the day, deciding what am I going to do with these remaining items, call, negotiate, delegate the task to a coworker. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Or work late. But the most important thing is you can leave work with a smile. Instead of the never-ending list of doom, now you're managing your time, you're in control, so morale gets to be better. So one last tip. Document the processes that you hate, the procedures that you hate. Who here likes writing documentation? Really? That many. Most technical people are like, I will do anything but write documentation. And I don't like writing documentation either, well, except I've written 4 books. but I do it because I love you. I don't like writing documentation, but the kind of documentation I do write is like little checklists. So, for example, the procedures I don't like to do, like the new user process. How do I create a new user? There's probably, it's not just, a little script anymore, because you have to create it on the main server, and maybe you have to deliver it on the PC, and do this and do that, 15 other things. Things that can't be automated, like physically delivering the machine. New user process, account termination, setting up new workstations, operating system upgrades. The benefit of, there's a number of benefits to documenting things as checklists. First of all, it's easy to do a checklist. You just throw it up on a wiki. It doesn't have to be perfect. And the benefit of putting it on a wiki is if one of your coworkers complains that it's not perfect, you say, well, it's a wiki. I look forward to your edits. It's good to do any kind of error-prone procedure. I used to have this one overly complicated RAID system that to change a disk, we always had to run to the manual and refind the steps to replace a broken disk. Instead, we just cut and paste those steps into the wiki, so it was just right there. The nice thing about documenting procedures that you don't like doing is maybe you're the only person in the group smart enough or technical enough to write this checklist, but once it's written, other more junior people can do it. And if they have a question, they can come to you and ask. So this creates the ability to delegate, which is something that most system administrators often feel they don't have the power to do. And not only just delegate, but when you're hiring for a new system administrator, often bosses will come to you and say, oh, you're doing great, we're going to hire another system, we want to hire a clone of you since you have so much work. You say, boss, I have a great deal for you. I'm going to save you money. Don't hire a clone of me. Hire a junior person.
To replace them.
What are they going to do? Well, I have this wiki. I mean, if you look at the table of contents, these are all the different things they can do. They can take care of new user creation, workstation delivery, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, when you're writing a job description, there's two parts to a job description. What are the responsibilities and what are their skills? What are the responsibilities? Well, just take that table of contents, cut and paste it in. What are their skills required? Well, if you click on each one of those things and see what skills are required. Well, you know, BSD experience, networking, blah, 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 blah. The job description practically writes itself. And now when you do hire this person, you're mentoring them. You have basically a training guide already because you have this documentation. And when they get really good at doing everything on the checklist and are starting to write their own checklist, you can promote, which is, you know, promoting from within. Every MBA will tell you that's, you know, the best way to run your business. So it creates a good dynamic within your group. And now someone else is doing all this tasks that you want to do. So ultimate time management tip is get other people to do the work. And that's how you can do that. So those are my top five tips. Thank you for your patience. And now I guess I can open it up to questions.
First of all, I'd like to say thanks for not wasting our time.
I have 50 other tips I could go to. I'd also like to tell you about how you can improve the TCO of your scan using my but, okay.
Are there any of these that don't scale well? Like, in my company, we're really implementers, more so. We have some managed services, but it's really a small part of the company, and that's why we don't have the ticketing system.
Right.
So, because if anything, we would use it internally just to track what we've done with our clients, sure. So that someone else can come along and see what the history is. So, is there any of these that don't scale well?
Don't scale down?
Yeah, don't scale down.
Oh, okay. So, are there any of these techniques that don't scale down?
Correct.
Well, it depends on how flexible you are. Like the mutual interrupt shield. Actually scales down if you only have one person. If you're the solo system administrator at a company, you can scale it down by talking to your boss and getting a deal that just in the morning, actually this happened to a friend of mine, Glenn, solo system in at a small company, so he couldn't use the mutual shield techniques, he did the solo shield technique. So the first hour of the day and the afternoon were for interrupts, and that gave him the middle 3 hours for project time. Now, if there was a fire, you know, a server crash or something, obviously he's going to, you know, jump up and, you know, not do his project, work on the fire. But by making this deal with his boss and the boss supporting it by sending out email to the company saying, you know, Glenn has some important projects to do, so I'm going to ask him to focus on that in the afternoons, but he's available, blah, blah, blah. It worked really well. So it depends on how creative you want to get. Do you use a bug tracking system since you said you're development oriented?
No,
we're implementation.
Yeah, reseller, kind of.
Think of a bug tracking system as a communication tool with your users. That's why I hate to see bug tracking software used as help desk software, because bug tracking is about collecting requirements and generating statistics so you can do process improvement. We've noticed that, you know, P0 bugs tend to take 6 days. We get this many per week. If we invest this much on better, you know, tools that would reduce the number of bugs and save money in XYZ. Help desk software is totally different. I look at it as a communication mechanism with your customers so that if you have the situation where customers say, I've been waiting for this for 6 months, you can go to the ticket and say, well, sorry, you filed the ticket 2 days ago. And your boss can say, look, you know, help me help you by filing tickets early. Or they say, oh, yeah, this ticket's been open 6 months, and your boss can rightfully go to you and not to one of your coworkers who shouldn't have been, you know, sitting on this for 6 months and get it done. So it helps in transparency and in communication. And also, it lets you go on vacation easier because you know that, you know, someone else could read the history of the ticket and pick it up. Yeah. Yes?
was just going to say, it kind of leads from what you just said. The difference between software development and systems administration. Can you articulate, do you feel that there's much of a difference in your time, in talking about how you discuss your time? And if there is, like, really, what's it about? So if you're a low system in a real software head job, or vice versa, what do you see as a beginning?
So what's the difference between time management for developers versus system administrators?
More or less, if you want.
Well, let me start with the perfect day for each, and then back up, how would I get there? So the perfect day for a developer is no meetings, just let me write some code. Meetings are this necessary evil, and I've never seen a successful software development team that prided itself on having the most meetings. If you're in a meeting-heavy environment, which parts of the software development cycle are often meeting-heavy, they have to be departments, department gathering and stuff. So it's about managing that meeting. And the technique I recommend is, at the beginning of the day, look at your calendar, say, how many meetings do I have? Generally, there's sort of three kind of days in my life. There's no meeting days, or maybe just one small one. There's meeting-heavy days, and sort of a mix. So if it's a no-meeting day, that's when I can look at my to-do list and say, oh, great, finally the opportunity to work on something big and heavy, something I've been putting off. Or something that, I know once I'm into it, I'm going to need to be in it for like 2 or 3 hours. And so now I'm picking my tasks that way. A meeting-heavy day, I look at my tasks and say, I'm not going to get any of this shit done. I better warn the people that have asked for this stuff. If I have deadlines, if you talk to my manager and say, this code is due today, I'm just not going to get it done. Can I skip these meetings? Can we send a representative to the meeting in place of me that'll take notes or whatever? Or can I just get a reprieve on the deadline? And then mixture days are a different management technique. That's if you have, like, worst case scenario, every other hours of meeting, that means you have maybe 4 or 5 isolated hours to actually get work done. One of them is lunch, so you've got really 3 or 4. So you can pick, so that means 2 things. One is you're either going to pick 3 small things or 1 big thing that you sort of break into chunks. And the other thing is, after each meeting, no hanging out at the water cooler, get right to your desk and ignore email, ignore everything. Because I get back from a meeting, check my email, and oh, it's time for the next meeting. So when you have a mixed day, you have to say, well, I'm just not going to read email today. If it was really important, there'd be like people running down the hall screaming. So that's how I think of things for, that's how I envision a software developer managing their time. Still, there's lots of, to-do list management and stuff that all applies. The ideal day for a system administrator is a boring day. A boring day, in my mind, would be a day where the documentation is all correct. Any manual that I read, any software I have to install, installs right on the first try, and no servers crash. That would be a really boring day for me. And I'd love tons of boring days like that, because I would use those days to do the things that I love about being a system administrator. I love playing with new hardware, trying new software, architecting large systems, and if I had a lot of boring days like that, I'd be able to do those fun things. So how do I manage my time so I have plenty of time for those things that I love about system administration? And a lot of that is the mutual interrupt shield, just time the to-do list management, things like that. So that's how we differentiate. And if there was one more chapter of the book, it would be what I just said about software development. And we actually were going to delay the book by a month to write that chapter, but O'Reilly decided that a book on time management shouldn't be a month later. So so. There's a hand back there. Yeah.
I was just wondering about the logistics of how you factor it into your list.
Mm-hmm.
You just have a folder with, you know, hundreds of your list, like exactly the day, or?
No, I have one very long text file. And in the morning, I scroll down to the bottom. Yeah. And, oh, the nice thing about that being one big text file is if you have to write weekly or quarterly reports, you have your report almost summarized for you. You pick up the big, meaty things, put it in your report, and you're done.
So you can sort of grab, you know, April 1st, April 15th, and say, okay, this is what I
need. Right. Now, the notes I take wouldn't be understood by anyone else, so often I have to translate it. And the minutiae, you know, if 15, instead of listing 15 times I, you know, create a new account, I'll just say, you know, create a 15 account. Mm-hmm.
Is there any particular reason why you don't reverse prong? I mean, cut it through with just your personal style?
I don't what?
Reverse prong the list.
Oh, no, because I'm a forward-thinking guy. Oh, Tom, you rest on me. You know, the number one advice in the book is do it your way. So yeah, if you wanted to do it reverse chronological, that's awesome. Mm-hmm.
When you do this, do you keep yourself, or do you see yourself like writing on a whiteboard saying, you know, this is my to-do list.
Okay.
You know, if you're accompanied with a new task, you know, it should be, you know,
right,
you show what
sure.
That this thing is that important, and you just always see how the mind gets, you know.
Okay, is the to-do list something I keep personal, or do I show it to other people? I tend to not show it to customers. When I say customers, I mean users, whoever I deal with, not, you know. For some people, customer means external people, and that could be internal. I generally don't show it to other people because mine, I integrate personal things, like not just have to buy milk on the way home, but other stuff. I wouldn't put it on a whiteboard because I can't carry my whiteboard with me everywhere I go, like I do with my laptop, or a PDA. There's tons of great software for PDAs. My favorite is called Datebook 6. It's for the Palm Pilot. I think it has, hands down, the best. It's the best because it lets you do this really easily. The one person I do show my list to is my boss. About maybe once a year, maybe every other year, I have a day that's so bad that I'm so overloaded that none of my normal techniques of negotiating and et cetera really work. So I take it to my boss and I say, boss, I'm so flooded. Here's what's on my plate. Help me. Tell me how I should prioritize these things. And I've gotten a couple different reactions. I've gotten the, wow, I had no idea you did so much reaction. I've had the, wait, users asked you to do blah, blah, blah? Oh, no. They're supposed to do that themselves. I'll go talk to them. Or if you tell them no, and if they don't like it, talk to me. And I've also had the, yeah, that's the level of performance we're expecting out of you, buddy, so get to work. And I've also had a boss once that rebalanced the workload among the whole team because I showed him what was on my list. So, luckily he didn't tell anyone. So I will show it to my boss. You don't want to do that every day because then your boss will be like, you know, this person can't manage their own life. But sure. The other time I show it to my boss is during an outage. So what's the worst thing about, you know, you have like an important server down, and the worst thing in the world is a boss that keeps coming to you. Is it done yet? Is it done yet? When's it going to be up? When's it going to be up? So that's when I pull up my to-do list and I say, boss, I have a very important task for you. These were the three things that these are the three deadlines I have to do today. Could you tell Mary that this isn't going to get done, and Joe that this isn't going to get done, and Sarah that this isn't going to get done? And he feels important. He has something to do. He does communicate to those users, and I can get working on my damn server. So, and I can only do that if I have a written to-do list that I can show him. So, other questions? Yes.
Can you give some minimizing the context switching?
Oh, how to minimize task switching?
Yeah, or just time switching between tasks.
Okay, minimizing switching between tasks. So, because the context switch is sort of a waste of time.
Yeah.
So it's a lot like a kernel CPU scheduler. You know, when switching between tasks is a certain number of instructions. And I remember, what was it? Kurt McCusick wrote that paper where he counted the exact number of instructions for a context switch in the Berkeley kernel, the BFT kernel versus the Linux kernel. It's like 3 times more in the Linux kernel. And like a week later, they had a patch where they, reduced it. And it's similar, for humans, it's similar, except we're not as accurate as the kernel. I mean, the kernel knows you have to save the registers and the stack pointer, blah, 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 blah. We're not so good at that. The worst outage in the world that I, not in the world, didn't affect the whole world, but the worst outage I ever created was I was doing something, I got interrupted, I came back, and I thought I had finished the previous thing, but I hadn't. Type, whole network down. Right, so it's coming back after an interrupt is error prone, and also it takes a little while to get back up to speed. Last year on Slashdot, someone mentioned a paper that it takes if you're like in the zone, it takes 5 minutes to get back in the zone, which means if you're getting interrupted more than once every 5 minutes, you're traveling backwards in time. But that's not answering your question. So, minimizing task switching. Well, one thing is the mutual interrupt shield. Another thing is a lot of the interrupts in our life we bring on ourselves. So when I'm in project mode, I shut off my instant messenger and my IRC and my you have an email reminder. Turn set your email client to only check an email every 2 hours. If you want new mail, click the get new mail button. And if you haven't clicked the new mail button for a full 2 hours, then yeah, you need to take a break and we'll tell you that you have email. If you're on BIF or XBIF or something to tell you when you have email, I don't use XBIF, I use BinTrue, because if I need to know if I have email, I run BinTrue. I know I always have email. So that's another thing. What else? Another thing is write down where you left off. And I find it excruciatingly difficult to do that. But especially if someone's standing there, I feel like if I say, 1 second, and I write down where I left off, even though that's probably like 3 seconds, and the person just thinks, oh, I'm an efficient person. He's writing down where he left off. In my brain, those 3 seconds feel like an hour, and that I'm being rude to this person. But in reality, 3 seconds probably, they're not even noticing. And also, if people want to jump in with their own ideas or suggestions, can be more interactive.
I think the kind of natural in practice problem with the scale issue, though, that came up is that, it's not beautifully scale-free when you do to-do lists. Scale-free, people know what scale-free means. It works on all levels
sure. When
you throw in a scenario. So you can go, do tests, create user, change shell, change password. Great. To-do list, that's really cute and sweet, and it's 3 quick things, and you go done, done, done. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, spec out a new storage system for 4 terabytes. Okay.
Oh, right. So that's going to be
bottom.
So a way to deal with that is, if a project's going to take 10 hours of cumulative time, you might schedule, I don't use the to-do list for that kind of thing. I actually use the calendar. I set a meeting with myself for maybe the next 10 Mondays, I'm going to spend 1 hour on something. Or on my to-do list, I'm going to chunk it into, a couple 2-hour items and pre-schedule them. I want to spend 2 hours on this each day this week, so I'll add to my next 5 to-do lists, 2 hours on second new first. And often something like that is, you make a phone call to a salesperson, they're not there, so what you thought was going to be 2 hours in a phone call is really 2 minutes, and then 2 hours some other time. So you can chunk it and put the chunks into your to-do list or your calendar. Another thing is to treat your to-do list as a cache of the tickets. So you might put, you know, every day I'm going to spend 2 hours doing nothing but seeing how many tickets I could run through from the help desk system. If it's always 2 hours and you work an 8-hour day, that leaves 6 hours for your remaining tasks. So I didn't talk about it in this top 5 tips, but there's some techniques for prioritizing and estimating how much work you have in a day. If you always are going to be doing 2 hours of tickets every day, then instead of planning 8 hours of work every day, you're planning 6 hours of work minus the number of meetings you have. Now getting it in big, you're probably going to have a team of people, and maybe if everyone does 1 hour, so actually when I was at Bell Labs, we had 10 people, and so from 8 in the morning to 8 at night, everyone had, you know, until 6 at night, everyone had a 1 hour slot where they did nothing but work on tickets. And they didn't have to fix everything in the queue, they had to at least delegate it to a more appropriate person and tell the user that, oh, this is a request that takes a while, but I've delegated it to someone. So the help desk was always being watched, and that let everyone have all their remaining time for projects.
How do I put this? The military strategy writer von Clausewitz wrote, "The ideal conditions of war are never met."
Sure.
Okay, so I have to spec out such and such a system. Well, I'm going to do spend an hour every Monday to do it, and I'm trying to work through because I know the way I work. I know it's not completely efficient. Mm-hmm. I know it's way too time-consuming, and there's that phone calls, emails, blah blah blah. You know, okay, I need a call back from the vendor to get a quote on the price, and I need to have a conversation to confirm that the drives and this customized rate system is going to be right. Well, sorry, they called during my schedule from 3 to 4. Then I'm playing phone tag with them. I mean, the point is that every little, the way the world is linked together, every little, hiccup causes hiccups all around the globe.
Correct.
And that's ultimately why when you're scaling, when you're scaling, every time I can sit there and go, get this, do this, boom, 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 and it's like, I'm banging things out, I'm crossing off my index cards, whatever I'm doing at the moment, and it feels great. Then all of a sudden, there's a larger project. Now, if I can take a larger project like that and break it down into enough small steps, great. Unfortunately, what ends up happening with all those small steps, and I'm actually curious, because I know other people definitely know what I'm talking about, and I'm sure you do some time. You break things out into little steps along the way, right? And then one step is too big, another is too small. Then there's the roadblock here, because when you thought about the larger project, you didn't consider, oh, this and this and this. Oh, the vendor who I usually get drives from, they were in a car accident. you literally go on and on and on and on. And the scale-free nature of things collapses with to-do lists. I just don't believe they're scale-free.
So for a big project, I don't try to break it into a million steps and put them all in the to-do list.
Yeah.
I try to list just the next step. The next step and things that might be tricky, like all of a sudden I remember, oh, the next time I talk to this salesperson, I need to ask blah, blah, blah. So on the item for, call salesman Bob, I might start adding, and ask about the such and such and ask about this. But one thing you can do is, there's a lot of little tricks you can do that combine. So for example, in your situation, I find that salespeople seem to get their brain erased at night, every night, so it's best to, the first thing in the morning, you put in all your phone calls, and then they call back within that day. Rather than, if you call them at the end of the day, then maybe they'll call you the next day. Also, things that have to be done every day, try to do them first. So like that emptying the water tank. Do that at the beginning of the day rather than on your way out realizing, oh, I have to empty that tank. Now, I'm running a little late for my after work thing. Now I'm going to be in later because I have to spend 2 minutes doing this. So the other way, you know, if you want to scale things really big, is you might have a team of people. You might have the storage team that's doing nothing but vendor management and stuff, and
speaking to them, hey, give me this, give me that.
Yeah, and so that they have some kind of standard. So, right. So if you have repetition, repetition. That my next book is might be about called Repetition. That would be a really boring title, so I feel like I just want to say this. I was thinking of calling The Joy in Run C and Joy of Repetition. Because if you find one storage solution and it works really well, and then you start churning those out every time someone needs a storage, you know, maybe you have a small, medium, large, standard storage system. So when people come to you and say, we need a small or we need a medium, it's just here, from the PO. A little more difficult to do in storage because the technology is changing a lot, but certainly, and this is what network people do, you know, they have, you know, every wiring closet has, you know, these three components or eight components if it's a small or a large.
Maybe Google.
And so at Google, where, so previous job, every time you buy a server, it's, wait, the master's at work, I'm going to pick the perfect server, and you talk to people, and you look at price guides, and you get the right number of interfaces, and this and that, and the other thing. At Google, we have two kinds of servers, because we make our own servers, and our data centers are just filled. You either have a rack of what we call disk full servers, or memory full servers. And you go to a website, and you say, okay, I need, you know, 400 servers, and you put in the request, and you watch the workflow come through, and so 80 servers per rack. If you wanted memory servers, that would be, what did I say, 300 servers? So you get 3-4 racks of servers. And that's repetition, baby, because that's not like I'm installing each server one at a time. That we're getting crate loads of servers, and the guys in the data center are just plugging them in. So that's really the ultimate in repetition.
Right, scale.
That's scale.
I mean, you're looking at, you know, being like three things to do before 10 a.m., you know, versus someone, you know, looking at a larger division of labor point that point.
Yeah, so a big, yeah, division of labor is really what you get in a really big system. But my friends at Yahoo, and I have no way of verifying this, but I'm told at Yahoo it's similar, but there's a whole lot of customization. So now they have a rack that's wired in a special way, with special equipment, and special everything, and if it dies, they need to build a second one. We have, you know, just this queuing system that if the process dies, the whole machine dies, and the process didn't finish, it just says, well, we have a machine just like it over here, and then it's the job there.
Yeah. I just saw that they committed a module for CF engine that controls these robots made by Honda to plug the...
That would be awesome.
I'm just kidding.
That would be so awesome. So if we had data centers that, and then robots that built the data centers for us, and then the data centers were used to do the computation to build more robots, then that would be the beginning of Skynet from Terminator and
the world. It's always moving with that.
There's a hand back there. Yes.
Do you guys using Parrot or to actually do the screen, you know, to bring the stuff live? I mean, in other words,
Does Google use Puppet?
How's
the provisioning done? We have an internal system in our production data centers. It's all a custom software system. On our desktops, though, we do use Puppet. In fact, this laptop is managed by Puppet. If I change certain wireless settings, it'll be changed back the next time Puppet comes.
But you don't do it in the data centers, just because the infrastructure was built out of
Puppet? Even though Puppet scales fantastically, and Luke has done a great job at getting to scale, it would not scale to what we do if we want.
Yeah. So meaning that the infrastructure doesn't, you can use Python, but it's using file stuff?
Yeah, a lot of, most of our infrastructure is C++. There's a lot of Python.
Well, I'm meaning specifically in the configuration stuff.
The configuration management stuff, it's a lot of Python, but it's a lot of C++ also. Yeah.
But as far as bringing up the server on the OS, is Pixie Boo able to
Yeah, Pixie Boo, I don't know what that's for. I mean, probably a lot of shell and some Python, but...
I think Pixie Boo is installed Windows with patches. I've seen Windows with patches installed, reboots and everything in a Pixie environment.
Oh, you've seen Pixie environments that... Oh, yes. Instead of like wiping the operating system, did some patching and got the machine back up. Oh, sure. Yeah, there's some... I'm a big fan of automating operating system loads and patching. It's chapter one of my first book, The Practice of System Network Administration. There we go. There's my URL. No matter how consistent you think you are when you manually load an operating system, you think you're consistent, your coworker thinks they're consistent, and if you sit down and discuss what you do, you're going to find differences. So if you can automate the hell out of that. Back in the old days, back in 94 or 95, when automating OS installs was brand new, the project that we did at the labs found that something like 80% of people's tickets that they were opening their first 3 months of employment at Bell Labs were really due to their machine not being installed correctly. And that there was this like, it was like 90% the first week and then it went down. And then 2 years later, they'd open a ticket that would be like, well, I've never actually used this software before, but now that but the first time I ran it, it blew up and you looked in some stupid setting, wasn't separate. And by automating operating OS loads, you not only reduce the number of tickets, but we improve customer satisfaction because, hey, you know, I've been in this company 2 months and I'm still finding all these problems. And then, of course, patching wasn't as important back then, but now it's just a security, what's the right term? Imperative. Yeah. Yes?
Is there any consideration, like, in terms of, like, thinking of different levels from a programmer, from a tester, from someone actually responsible for a particular part of the infrastructure for hardware generations? Like, I know that there's a lot of, you know, super redundancies, all the software there. Failover, active failover, all that. But is there any thought like, oh, geez, I don't want that running over there because I know that generation has got 4 gigs of RAM for Node, and this one's, you know, F16 or, you know, whatever. Or is that completely abstracted out?
At Google, we, our queuing system, it's a real pain for the poor developers when they submit a job into the system, they have to say how much RAM and how much disk space, and then the queuing system does a bin packing kind of thing. And now you would think you'd actually want an anti-bin packing system. You actually want to spread the processes out among your machines as much as possible so that each machine is as lightly loaded as possible, right? But we just published a paper about energy efficiency, and what we found is server hardware is very energy efficient at 100% utilization and at zero. Because at zero, you know, because of all that laptop technology, the processor slows down and uses almost no electricity if it's unused. And at 100% utilization, well, hey, you buy a $1,000 box, you're getting $1,000 worth of computing. The interesting thing is, you would think it'd be linear, but actually from 0 to 50%, power efficiency sucks. And it's at 50% to 100% that you get any kind of good power efficiency on hardware, Intel hardware as built today. This could change 5 years from now. So as a result, what you really want in your queuing system is to load if a machine is running any processes at all, you want it in the 50 to 100% range. So it's actually, you are bin packing, and then all the other machines, make them so idle that they go into these power savings. So really, what you want, like if you had a big like VMware farm, what you would really want is for its allocation to get every machine into like the 80 or 90 percentile of utilization, and all the machines that aren't being used, power them off. Have VMware control your power products. And then when you do need the computation, power up machines. That's actually the most energy efficient way of running your system. And if you think about, so energy is really our only cost in data centers. If you think about it, open source has taken the cost of, well, let's say, we start with Moore's Law. Moore's Law has made systems go from $50,000 to $1,000, so they're essentially free. And I mean, Moore's Law, the cost of hardware is trending towards zero. And open source, the cost of the software on our servers is trending towards zero. Remember the first dot-com boom, every server you bought was a $50,000 server with a $1,000 license and a $50,000 Oracle license and et cetera, et cetera. So machines were $100,000 each. And now, like I said, Moore's Law is dropping the hardware cost, open source is dropping the software cost, both trending towards zero. So what's left? Rent and power. So if you're not managing your power, that's really your only cost, so what are you doing?
And you.
And that's why, so at Google, we don't really hire system administrators. We hire software developers that know system administration. So we never throw people at a problem, we throw code at problems. So actually, what I was talking about with the mutual interrupt shield is in the system administration group, we have 1 week out of five that we do nothing but carry the pager and tickets and stuff, and the other 4 weeks out of five, we are just working on projects. We're just coding our way out of problems. And for different teams, it's different. I mean, I know some teams are 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 3, but so our whole structure is around a mutual interrupt shield at an extreme so that we're writing code most of the time. Yeah?
One last question
for
the team. Are you guys finding anything in terms of the actual efficiency of being able to use multi force? Like, in other words, actually finding that you're able to, there's the actual CPU, but then on the core level, like, in other words, extrapolating that over the next 5 or 10 years, everyone's talking about going to, whatever it's going to be, 1,000.
Sure, we're going to have 100 or 1,000 cores on our CPU.
And are you guys seeing any metrics as to how well that's actually going to work out in terms of the cost benefit of having that on the CPU?
Sure. We're seeing 30 years of people going to college not being taught how to write software for multi-core CPUs. And that is a major problem. You have a single-threaded process on an 8-core CPU, and you're never going to get better than 1/8 efficiency out of that machine unless you stack more processes on. So I can say yes. What conclusions we've drawn, I have no idea. It's not my group, but I guess you could get someone from Google to talk on that. It's a bad situation. People need to, write more threaded code. You're an asshole user, aren't you?
If you say pretty much anything in threads, you're asking for disaster unless you're dealing with somebody who really, really, really knows what they're doing.
Well, that's true.
It's so, writing software.
But remember,
writing software.
Any problem that we have, the database people probably solved 15 years ago, and that's why I'm placing my bets on transactional memory.
Now, same kind of anal retentivity to be like database work, same kind of anal retentivity has to go with the threaded work,
right?
And you don't have a nice mathematical model with threads.
Right, but that's because of locks. And database people stopped using locks years ago to use transactions.
Yeah.
And so there's this whole thing, now I'm really talking about stuff I don't myself understand, but I'm betting that 5 years from now we don't do locks at all. We use transactional memory, and if I'm wrong, I'll buy you dinner.
AMD was trying to create a front end for software to make their multiple cores look like one.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, I don't think it, not for a while.
I used to be a hardware person, but that was when, you know, RISC was new. All this new stuff confuses me. What time are we running to?
Whatever you've done.
I have to take more questions. I have one more thing. I have a couple more backup slides. I can, you can ask more questions about Google. Yeah.
We can wrap up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your time.